They were what families were supposed to be like. Why didn't my mother have freshly baked cookies ready when I came home from school? Why didn't we live in a house with a backyard and a front yard instead of an old apartment? I remember looking at my mother as she cleaned the house in her old, raggedy house coat with her hair in curlers. How disgusting, I would think. Why didn't she clean the house in high heels and shirtwaist dresses like they did on television? I began to resent my chores. The kids on television never had any work to do. All they did was their homework, and then they went out to play. They never went to the laundromat or did the shopping. They never had to do the dishes or scrub the floor or empty the garbage. They didn't even have to make their own beds. And the kids on television got everything they wanted. Their parents never said, "I don't have the money, I can't afford it." I had very little sympathy for my mother. It never occurred to me that she worked all day, went to school at night, cooked, cleaned, washed and ironed, raised two children, and in her spare time, graded tests and papers and wrote her thesis. I was furious with her because she wasn't like Donna Reed. And of course, the commercials took another toll. I wanted everything I saw. My mother always bought brand X. I would be so exasperated when we went shopping. I wanted her to buy Hostess Twinkies and Silver Cup white bread. Instead, she bought whole wheat bread and apples. She would never get good cereal like Sugar Crunchies and Cocoa Puffs. She always bought some stuff that was supposed to be good for us. I thought she was crazy. If Hostess Twinkies were good enough for the kids on TV, then why weren't they good enough for me? But my mother remained unmoved, and I remained disgusted. I was a puppet, and I didn't even know who was pulling the strings. One year, everybody was wearing buttons on their coats. Some had writing on them, and others had pictures of movie stars. I went somewhere with my mother and my aunt, and they asked me if I wanted a button. I picked out one with Elvis Presley on it. All the kids at school thought Elvis Presley was cool. I wore that button religiously, all winter, and that summer when I went down south, I went to see one of Elvis Presley's movies. In Wilmington at the time, there was only one movie theater where black people were allowed to go. It was called the Bailey Theater. Once you bought your ticket, you went up a long staircase on the side of the theater to the second balcony, the colored section. Shame on you if you were nearsighted. The movie was like all the rest of Elvis's movies, forgettable. When it was over, I went downstairs. All the white kids were leaving with pictures of Elvis Presley that they had bought. I started to walk to my grandparents' restaurant on Red Cross Street, but then I turned around and walked back. If the white kids could have a picture of Elvis, then so could I. At least I was going to try. I knew it would be absolutely no use to go to the ticket booth and ask the woman anything. She would most assuredly say no. So I walked right on past her, straight into the white section of the theater. What a surprise it was. It was just like the movies in New York. They had soda machines, a butter popcorn machine, and all kinds of candy and potato chips and things. Upstairs in the colored section, they had some old stale plain popcorn and a few candy bars, and that was it. The moment I walked in, all the action stopped. Everybody's eyes were on me. I walked over to the counter where they were selling the pictures. Before I could open my mouth, the sales girl told me, "You're in the wrong section. Just go outside and go up the stairs on the side." "I want to buy a picture of Elvis Presley," I said. "What'd you say again?" she drawled. "I want to buy a picture of Elvis Presley," I repeated. "They don't have any upstairs." "Well, I don't know," she said. "I'll have to get the manager." She said something to the other woman behind the counter and then left. By this time, a crowd had gathered around me. "What's she doing in here?" they kept asking each other. "Now she knows better," somebody was saying. "Look, Ma, a colored girl." "You get lost, honey." "What's she want?" "Don't they have no pictures in the colored section?" "What she need with a picture anyway?" The crowd was all around me, gawking. It seemed like the manager would never come. "Can't she read? Don't she know we don't allow no colored in here? I don't know what it's about. Something about a picture. Can't walk in right in here bold as day. Finally, the sales girl came back. A man was with her. All eyes were fixed on the manager. He took one look at me and another look at the crowd forming around me. Give her the picture and get her out of here, he told the sales girl. Hurriedly, she sold me the picture. All right, folks, it's all over now. Go on about your business. I took my picture and went prancing out into the daylight. I was feeling good. It seemed funny when I thought about it. The looks on those crackers' faces all puffed up like balloons. I had a good time laughing all the way to my grandparents' house. And of course, the minute I got there, I told everybody what happened. I was just so proud. I took my picture and put it on the back counter right next to the funeral parlor calendar. The picture stayed there for a few days, until Johnny from the cab stand across the street came and told me that Elvis had said the only thing a black person could do for him was to buy his records and shine his shoes. Quietly, I slid the picture into obscurity, then oblivion. Later, I read that Elvis had given Spiro Agnew a gold-plated .357 Magnum and had volunteered to work for the FBI. Evelyn, my aunt, was the heroine of my childhood. She was always taking me places and exposing me to things, as she called it. She took me to museums. I think we visited just about every museum in the city of New York. She turned me into a real art lover. Before I was 10, I could recognize a Van Gogh on sight, and I knew what cubism, surrealism, and abstract expressionism were. Picasso, Gauguin, Van Gogh, and Modigliani were my favorite artists. I didn't know the name of one black artist in those days. Very few, if any, museums exhibited the work of black artists, so I just assumed that black people weren't too good at painting. But I learned about African art from my mother. From the time I can remember, my mother always had African sculpture in the house. It was the only kind she had. I always loved those pieces, and it really annoyed me when I took art history in school, and the teacher referred to African art as primitive. In fact, if the art was by anyone else but a white person, it was called primitive art. In addition to museums, Evelyn would take me to see plays and movies, and we would experiment with all kinds of restaurants. We would go to parks, go bicycle riding, and it was Evelyn who gave me my first rowboat lesson. She was very sophisticated and knew all kinds of things. She was right up my alley because I was forever asking all kinds of questions. I wanted to know everything. She would give me a book and say, "Read this," and I would eat up that book like it was ice cream. It was Evelyn who took me to see my first show at the Apollo. We saw Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. I was walking on clouds. After that, as soon as I learned to ride the subway by myself, I went to the daytime shows. If my mother and aunt had known, they would have had a fit. I guess people wondered what this little girl was doing in the Apollo all by herself, but nobody ever bothered me. I was always pretty lucky that way. Barbara was a little girl who lived next door to us in Queens. She was my main friend and foe for quite a while. One day I saw her leaving her house wearing a white dress and a little white veil like a bride wears. Everything she had on was white, all the way down to her shoes. She even had a little white Bible in her hands. I thought she was going to be in a Tom Thumb wedding like they have down south. So I went up to her and asked her who she was marrying. She said she was making her first communion, that she was Catholic. Well, I became an instant convert. I wanted to wear a white dress and dress up like a bride too. And the Catholics even got out early from school on Wednesdays. I raced home to tell my mother. My mother was very permissive where religion was concerned. She gave us carte blanche to be Catholics, Baptists, Methodists, or whatever. So I started going to Mass and to catechism classes on Wednesday. The Catholic Church was like no other church I had ever been to. Down south, I always went to church, but those services were rich with music and emotion. I would sit caught up in the music and watch those people who got happy or got the spirit, jumping around all over the place. I was never holy, but I liked going to church. In the black churches that I had been in, the air was charged. The music rocked and the preacher preached and sang at the same time. People felt free to do what they needed to do. If they felt like dancing, they danced. If they felt like praying, they prayed. If they felt like screaming, they screamed. And if they felt like crying, they cried. The church was there to give them strength and to get them through the long week ahead of them. Where we lived in Queens, there was no black church. The Catholic church was different. It was silent and cold. The music was terrible, and you couldn't understand 9/10 of the service. But what fascinated me was the spookiness of it. They had so much weird stuff attached to their religion. When you walked in the door, you had to cross yourself with holy water. Then before you could sit down, you had to genuflect. And throughout the Mass, you were forever up and down, sitting, standing, and kneeling. There was so much stuff to learn. The stations of the cross, rosary beads, lighting candles, going to confession. It was all so spooky, I just knew that this had to be the real God. The nuns really tripped me out. They walked around with rings on their fingers saying they were married to God. That was really weird. And they could never have children or do it, and people said they had bald heads under their habits. I was simply overwhelmed. The catechism class was nothing like Sunday school. They never told good stories about Jesus, and we never sang, "Yes, Jesus loves me." In catechism class, we learned all about the saints. It seemed like they had a million of them. And then there was the Virgin Mary. They made a big deal out of her. They even had us praying to her. I would do it, but that story was always kind of hard for me to swallow. Nothing about the Catholics was simple. They even had different kinds of hell. They had a special one for babies, and then they had one in between, and then they had the show-nuff hell. They even had two kinds of sin. I can still hear that nun as if it were yesterday. Now, a venial sin is a sin that's not so bad. It's a white sin. But a mortal sin is terrible. It is a black sin. The night before I was to make my first communion, I had to run to the church with my baptismal certificate. They needed it to prove I had been baptized. My mother had had a hell of a time finding it. I was tickled to be going because they told me to bring it to the convent where the nuns lived. I had been dying to see what it looked like inside. It was just as cold and lifeless as the church. When I gave the nun my baptismal certificate, she looked at it and almost jumped out of her chair. "Oh no, this won't do," she said. "This is not a Catholic baptismal certificate. You weren't really baptized." "What?" I said. "I was too baptized." "No, you weren't," she said. "It's not a Catholic baptism, so it doesn't count. You'll have to be baptized tonight, or you can't make your first communion tomorrow." I was not ready for that one. I caught an instant attitude. She was talking about my godparents like they were dirt under her feet. They called my mother and told her she had to come to the church. Then they got these total strangers from somewhere and told me they were supposed to be my godparents, and they baptized me. I never saw those people again, and if you ask me their names, I couldn't tell you. I had had a godmother all my life, and here they were telling me she wasn't my godmother because she wasn't Catholic. They really made me mad that day, but I didn't say too much about it. I really wanted to make my first communion. I did, and later my confirmation, but I never looked at them the same. The sixth grade passed along rather uneventfully. There was another black in my class, Gail. We became friendly, but my relationship with the white kids deteriorated even more. They made it pretty evident that they didn't care too much for me. And I made it clear right back that I didn't care for them. The thing I disliked most about them was their assumptions about me. For one thing, they automatically assumed that I was stupid. And they would really act surprised when I showed I had some brains. One of the biggest fights I had was when this kid in my class couldn't find some pen that his father had given him and accused me of stealing it. I waited for him outside the classroom, and as soon as he came out the door, I jumped on him like a crazy person. Some teachers broke us up. "I'm surprised at you," they kept saying. I never thought you'd act that way. I was usually very quiet and well-behaved. They acted like I had jumped on that boy for nothing, and they couldn't understand why I was so angry. As a matter of fact, even I didn't understand, then. Outside of school was a whole nother matter. When I wasn't doing homework or chores, I would go exploring. My bicycle was one of the great loves of my life. I would jump on it and ride all over Queens. Sometimes on Saturdays or Sundays, I would ride all day long, leaving early in the morning and returning as late as I was allowed to. And if I wasn't on my bicycle, I was somewhere playing with my friends. We played everything from house to handball. I played with the boys more than with the girls because the boys had better games. I loved punchball and handball, anything that involved running. The playground was right across the street from my house, and I took full advantage of everything that was there. I played hopscotch, marbles, and cowboys and Indians. I always wanted to be an Indian and would hide over or under something and leap out shrieking at the top of my lungs. I guess I was unusual in that respect, because most of the kids wanted to be cowboys. I was always rough and clumsy, and I played everything as if my life depended on it. Some of the girls didn't like to play with me because they said I was too rough, and I was always excluded from the rope jumping sessions. I was too clumsy to jump double dutch, and they didn't even like me to turn because they said I was uneven-handed. But I always had one best friend, and she was always a girl. I had other friends to play with and hang out with, but I always had one special friend that I could really talk to. We would go to the candy store and the movies and places like that, and we would sit and talk for hours about just anything. By the time I reached the sixth grade, I began to idolize and imitate the big kids who went to junior high school. I couldn't wait to grow up. The grown-up world was so exciting, and when you were grown up, you could do anything you wanted to. Besides, I was beginning to feel different. I was beginning to be interested in boys. Cracker Jacks. I could have told you, in the old days, in the park, or skating down some hill, what it was all about. I could have sat next to you on some stairway and gave you half my bubble gum, and in between the bubbles and the giggles, I could have told you. But we are grown up now, and it is all so complicated when you dig somebody. Now when I open up my Cracker Jacks, I find no heart-shaped ring, only a puzzle that I don't want to solve. Chapter 3. It seemed like the middle of the night. Someone was calling me, waking me up. What did they want? Suddenly I was aware of all kinds of activity. Police, the crackling of walkie-talkies, the place was buzzing. Here, put this on, one of them said, handing me a bathrobe. What's going on? I asked. You're being moved. Where am I being moved to? You'll find out when you get there. A wheelchair was waiting. I figured they were taking me to jail. There was a caravan of police cars outside the hospital. It looked like I was going to be in a parade again. The ride was pleasant. Just looking at houses and trees and people passing by in cars was good. We arrived at the prison at sunrise, in the middle of nowhere. It was an ugly two-story brick building. They pushed me up the stairs to the second floor. I was put in a cell with two doors. A door of bars was on the inside, and directly outside of that was a heavy metal door with a tiny peephole that I could barely see through. The cell contained a cot with a rough green blanket on it and a dirty white wooden bench with 100 names scratched on it. Adjacent to the cell was the bathroom with a sink, a toilet, and a shower. Hanging above the sink was the bottom of a pot or pan. It was supposed to serve as a mirror, but I could barely see myself in it. There was one window covered by three thick metal screens facing a parking lot, a field, and in the distance, a wooded area. I walked around the cell to the bath, to the window, to the door. back and forth until I had tired myself out. I was still pretty weak. Then I lay down on the cot and wondered what this place was going to be like. Here I was, my first day in prison. In about an hour, a guard unlocked the outside door and asked me if I wanted breakfast. I said yes, and in a few minutes she came back with eggs and bread in a plastic bowl and a metal cup containing something that was supposed to be coffee. The eggs didn't taste too bad. Maybe prison food isn't as bad as they say it is, I remember thinking. I heard voices, and it was clear they weren't police voices. Then the radio came on. Black music. It sounded so good. I looked through the peephole and saw faces, weird and distorted because of the concave glass, but black faces to match the black voices I had heard. "How y'all doing?" I asked. No response. Then I realized how thick the metal door was, so I shouted this time. "How y'all doing?" A chorus of muffled fines came back. I was feeling good. Real people were just on the other side of the wall. The guard opened the metal door and handed me some uniforms. Maid's uniforms. Royal blue, white buttons, collars, and cuffs. I kept trying them on until two of them fit. Then she gave me a huge cotton slip that looked like a tent dress and a nightgown that looked exactly like the slip. "You are entitled to a clean uniform once a week." Once a week, I nearly screeched. They had to be crazy. Behind the guard, through the open door, I could see some of the black women standing around. They were all, it seemed, black. They smiled and waved at me. It was so good to see them. It was like a piece of home. "When are you going to unlock me and let me go out there?" I asked, motioning to the other women. The guard looked surprised. "I don't know. You'll have to ask the warden." "Well, when can I see the warden?" I pushed. "I don't know." "Well, why am I being locked in here? Why can't I go out there with the other women?" "I don't know." "Then why can't you let me out?" "We were told you were to remain in your room." "Well, how long am I supposed to stay in here, locked up like this?" "I don't know." I saw it was useless. "Would you please tell the warden or the sheriff that I would like to see him?" I requested. The guard locked the door and was gone. The metal door was unlocked again. An ugly, shriveled white woman stood in front of the bars. "My name is Mrs. Butterworth, and I am the warden of the women's section of the workhouse." She reminded me of a dilapidated horse. "Well, Joanne, is there something I can do for you?" I didn't like her looks or her tone of voice, but I decided to ignore that for the moment and get to the business at hand. "When can I be unlocked from this cell and go outside in the big room with the other women?" "Well, I don't know, Joanne. Why do you want to go out there?" "Well, I don't want to stay in here all day locked up by myself." "Why, Joanne, don't you like your room?" "It's a very nice room. We had it painted just for you." "That's not the point," I said. "I would like to know when I will be able to be with the other women." "Well, Joanne, I don't know when you'll be able to come out. You see, we have to keep you in here for your own safety because there are threats on your life." "You know, Joanne," she said, lowering her voice like she was speaking confidentially, "cop killers are not very popular in correctional institutions. Have any of the women here made threats against me?" "Well, I don't know, but I'm sure they have." "I'll bet," I said to myself. "Nobody has threatened my life. They just don't want to let me out of here." "Well, Joanne, the important thing is for you to behave and to cooperate with us so we'll be able to send a good report to the judge. It's important for our girls to behave like ladies." This woman was making me sick. Did she think I was fool enough to believe that either she or the judge was going to help me in any way? But it was a superior-sounding tinge to her voice that really ticked me off. "Butterworth, is it?" I asked. "What's your first name?" "Why, I never tell my girls my first name." "I'm not one of your girls. I'm a grown woman. Why don't you tell people your first name? Are you ashamed of it?
No, Joanne. I'm not ashamed of my name. It's a matter of respect. I am the warden here. My girls call me Mrs. Butterworth, and I call them by their first names.
Well, you haven't done anything for me to respect you for. I give people respect only when they earn it. Since you won't tell me your first name, then I want you to call me by my last name. You can either call me Miss Shakur or Miss Chesimard. I'm not going to call you by your last name. I'm going to continue calling you Joanne. Well, that's okay by me if you can stand me calling you Miss Bitch whenever I see you. I don't give anybody respect when they don't respect me. Lock the door, she told the guard and walked away. Days passed. Evelyn called the sheriff, the warden. There were two wardens in that jail, Butterworth and a man named Cahill. Cahill had all the power, though. Butterworth was only a figurehead. And everybody else. Nothing more could be done outside of going to court. I had little or no feeling in my right arm. I knew I needed physical therapy if I was ever to use it again. I had learned to write with my left hand, but that was no substitute. I needed a more specific diagnosis of exactly what had been damaged before I would know whether or not I would ever use it again, even with physical therapy. Isolation was driving me up the walls. I needed materials to write and to draw, paint, or sketch. All my requests went unheeded. I was permitted nothing, including peanut oil and a small ball to aid movement in my arm. When the jail doctor examined me, I asked him about my arm. Why, we doctors aren't gods, you know. There's nothing anyone can do when someone is paralyzed. But they said I might get better, I protested. Oh yes, and the physical therapist at Roosevelt Hospital said that some peanut oil might help. Peanut oil? He asked, laughing. That's a good one. I can't write a prescription for that now, can I? My advice to you is to forget about all that stuff. You don't need any of it. Sometimes in life we just have to accept things that are unpleasant. You still have one good arm. I kept talking, but I could see I was wasting my time. He had no intention of trying to help me. Well, would you at least prescribe some vitamin B? All right, but you really don't need it. Every time they called me to see the doctor after that, I went reluctantly. He would take my arm out of the sling and move it back and forth about 2 inches. Oh yes, you're getting better, he would say. I always asked about physical therapy, and he always said there was nothing he could do. Finally, Evelyn went to court. Some of the items we petitioned for were ridiculous. In addition to physical therapy and nerve tests, we asked for peanut oil, a rubber ball, a rubber grip, books, and stuff to draw or paint with. The court finally granted a physical therapist if we would find one and pay the bill, but I never got one. It seemed that no physical therapist in Middlesex County was willing to come to the prison to treat me, and only a physical therapist from Middlesex County was permitted. But I did get the peanut oil and the grip, and in a short time I had a whole physical therapy program worked out. I was receiving a lot of mail from all over the country. Most of it came from people I didn't know, mostly militant black people, either in the streets or in prison. I got some hate mail, though, and some letters from religious people who were trying to save my soul. I wasn't able to answer all of those letters because the prison permitted us to write only 2 letters a week, subject to inspection and censorship by the prison authorities. It was hard for me to write anyway. I was also very paranoid about letters. I could not bear the thought of the police, FBI, guards, whoever, reading my letters and getting daily insight on how I was feeling and thinking. But I would like to offer my sincerest apology to those who were kind enough to write to me over the years and who received no answer. I spent my first month at the Middlesex County Workhouse writing. Evelyn had brought some newspaper clippings, and it was obvious the press was trying to railroad me to make me seem like a monster. According to them, I was a common criminal, just going around shooting down cops for the hell of it. I had to make a statement. I had to talk to my people and let them know what I was about, where I was really coming from. The statement seemed to take forever to write. I wanted to make a tape of it and enlisted Evelyn's help. As my lawyer, she was dead set against it and advised me not to make the tape. But as a black woman living in America, Evelyn understood why it was important and necessary. When the prosecutor found out about the tape, he tried to get her thrown off the case. She was ordered by the court never to bring a tape recorder again when she visited me. I made the tape of To My People on July 4th, 1973, and it was broadcast on many radio stations. Here is what I said. Black brothers, black sisters, I want you to know that I love you, and I hope that somewhere in your hearts you have love for me. My name is Asada Shakur, slave name, Joanne Chesimard, and I am a revolutionary, a black revolutionary. By that I mean I have declared war on all forces that have raped our women, castrated our men, and kept our babies empty-bellied. I have declared war on the rich who prosper on our poverty, the politicians who lie to us with smiling faces, and all the mindless, heartless robots who protect them and their property. I am a black revolutionary, and as such, I am a victim of all the wrath, hatred, and slander that America is capable of. Like all other black revolutionaries, America is trying to lynch me. I am a black revolutionary woman, and because of this, I have been charged with and accused of every alleged crime in which a woman was believed to have participated. The alleged crimes in which only men were supposedly involved, I have been accused of planning. They have plastered pictures, alleged to be me, in post offices, airports, hotels, police cars, subways, banks, television, and newspapers. They have offered over $50,000 in rewards for my capture, and they have issued orders to shoot on sight and shoot to kill. I'm a black revolutionary, and by definition, that makes me part of the Black Liberation Army. The pigs have used their newspapers and TVs to paint the Black Liberation Army as vicious, brutal, mad dog criminals. They have called us gangsters and gun mauls and have compared us to such characters as John Dillinger and Ma Barker. It should be clear. It must be clear to anyone who can think, see, or hear that we are the victims. The victims and not the criminals. It should also be clear to us by now who the real criminals are. Nixon and his crime partners have murdered hundreds of Third World brothers and sisters in Vietnam, Cambodia, Mozambique, Angola, and South Africa. As was proved by Watergate, the top law enforcement officials in this country are a lying bunch of criminals. The president, two attorney generals, the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA, and half the White House staff have been implicated in the Watergate crimes. They call us murderers, but we did not murder over 250 unarmed black men, women, and children or wound thousands of others in the riots they provoked during the 60s. The rulers of this country have always considered their property more important than our lives. They call us murderers, but we were not responsible for the 28 brother inmates and 9 hostages murdered at Attica. They call us murderers, but we did not murder and wound over 30 unarmed black students at Jackson State or Southern State either. They call us murderers, but we did not murder Martin Luther King Jr., Emmett Till, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, George Jackson, Nat Turner, James Chaney, and countless others. We did not murder by shooting in the back 16-year-old Rita Lloyd, 11-year-old Ricky Bodden, or 10-year-old Clifford Glover. They call us murderers, but we do not control or enforce a system of racism and oppression that systematically murders black and third world people. Although black people supposedly comprise about 15% of the total American population, at least 60% of murder victims are black. For every pig that is killed in the so-called line of duty, there are at least 50 black people murdered by the police. Black life expectancy is much lower than white, and they do their best to kill us before we are even born. We are burned alive in fire-trap tenements. Our brothers and sisters OD daily from heroin and methadone. Our babies die from lead poisoning. Millions of black people have died as a result of indecent medical care. This is murder. But they have got the gall to call us murderers. They call us kidnappers, yet Brother Clark Squire, who is accused along with me of murdering a New Jersey state trooper, was kidnapped on April 2, 1969, from our black community and held on $1 million ransom in the New York Panther 21 conspiracy case. He was acquitted on May 13, 1971, along with all the others, of 156 counts of conspiracy by a jury that took less than 2 hours to deliberate. Brother Squire was innocent, yet he was kidnapped from his community and family. Over 2 years of his life was stolen, but they call us kidnappers. We did not kidnap the thousands of brothers and sisters held captive in America's concentration camps. 90% of the prison population in this country are black and third world people who cannot afford neither bail nor lawyers. They call us thieves and bandits. They say we steal, but it was not we who stole millions of black people from the continent of Africa. We were robbed of our language, of our gods, of our culture, of our human dignity, of our labor, and of our lives. They call us thieves, yet it is not we who rip off billions of dollars every year through tax evasions, illegal price fixing, embezzlement, consumer fraud, bribes, kickbacks, and swindles. They call us bandits, yet every time most black people pick up our paychecks, we are being robbed. Every time we walk into a store in our neighborhoods, we are being held up. And every time we pay our rent, the landlord sticks a gun into our ribs. They call us thieves, but we did not rob and murder millions of Indians by ripping off their homeland, then call ourselves pioneers. They call us bandits, but it is not we who are robbing Africa, Asia, and Latin America of their natural resources and freedom, while the people who live there are sick and starving. The rulers of this country and their flunkies have committed some of the most brutal, vicious crimes in history. They are the bandits. They are the murderers, and they should be treated as such. These maniacs are not fit to judge me, Clark, or any other black person on trial in America. Black people should and inevitably must determine our destinies. Every revolution in history has been accomplished by actions, although words are necessary. We must create shields that protect us and spears that penetrate our enemies. Black people must learn how to struggle by struggling. We must learn by our mistakes. I want to apologize to you, my black brothers and sisters, for being on the New Jersey Turnpike. I should have known better. The Turnpike is a checkpoint where black people are stopped, searched, harassed, and assaulted. Revolutionaries must never be in too much of a hurry or make careless decisions. He who runs when the sun is sleeping will stumble many times. Every time a black freedom fighter is murdered or captured, the pigs try to create the impression that they have quashed the movement, destroyed our forces, and put down the black revolution. The pigs also try to give the impression that 5 or 10 guerrillas are responsible for every revolutionary action carried out in America. That is nonsense. That is absurd. Black revolutionaries do not drop from the moon. We are created by our conditions, shaped by our oppression. We are being manufactured in droves in the ghetto streets, places like Attica, San Quentin, Bedford Hills, Leavenworth, and Sing Sing. They are turning out thousands of us. Many jobless black veterans and welfare mothers are joining our ranks. Brothers and sisters from all walks of life who are tired of suffering passively make up the BLA. There is and always will be, until every black man, woman, and child is free, a Black Liberation Army. The main function of the Black Liberation Army at this time is to create good examples, to struggle for black freedom, and to prepare for the future. We must defend ourselves and let no one disrespect us. We must gain our liberation by any means necessary. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. In the spirit of Ronald Carter, William Christmas, Mark Clark, Mark Essex, Frank Heavy Fields, Woody Chonga Alukbala Green, Fred Hampton, Lil Bobby Hutton, George Jackson, Jonathan Jackson, James McLean, Harold Russell, Zaid Malik Shakur, Anthony Kumu Olugbala White. We must fight on. The workhouse had a whole heap of rules, most of them stupid. No newspapers or magazines were permitted. When I asked why we couldn't read newspapers, they told me that newspapers were inflammatory. Obviously, if a person read in the paper that his or her sister had been raped, he would wait until the rapist came to jail and then do him bodily harm. But, I protested, the other inmates watched television and listened to the radio. I wasn't allowed either. They could receive the same information that way or from a visit from home. In that case, the warden told me, we don't let you read newspapers because they are a fire hazard. One of the saddest rules prohibited children from visiting their mothers in jail. I could see the children waiting outside, looking up at that ugly old building with sad, frustrated faces. Their mothers would run to the only window that faced the parking lot just to get a glimpse of their children. Yelling out of the window was a no-no, but once in a while somebody would get carried away. Sometimes their frantic screams went unheard. Gradually, I began to know the women. They were all very kind to me and treated me like a sister. They laughed like hell when I told them that I was supposedly being protected from them. Those first days before I had really learned to maneuver with one hand, they did whatever they could to make things easier for me. They volunteered to iron my uniform and sneak them into the laundry to be washed more than once a week. When they told me their charges and the time they were doing, I couldn't believe it. Quite a few of them were doing time for the numbers, either 6 months or a year. In New York, doing time for number running was practically unheard of. And it certainly didn't get you 6 months or a year. Everybody in the world knows that the numbers business keeps the cops fat. These women hadn't hurt anybody or stolen anything. Yet they were sitting in jail, probably busted by the same cops that they paid off. Their only crime was competing with the state lottery. Most of them had already been sentenced. If the sentence was less than a year, time was served in the county jail rather than in the state penitentiary. If I had expected to find so-called hardened criminals or big-time female gangsters or gun mols in the workhouse, I would have been sadly disappointed. The rest of the women who weren't doing time for the numbers were in for some form of petty theft like shoplifting or passing bad checks. Most of those sisters were on welfare and all of them had been barely able to make ends meet. The courts had shown them no mercy. They brought in this sister shortly after I arrived who was 8 months pregnant and had been sentenced to a month for shoplifting something that cost less than $20. Later, a middle-aged sister began coming to the workhouse on weekends. She worked during the week and served her 6 month sentence for drunken driving on weekends. Knowing that white women with the same charges would never have received such a sentence, I thought it was harsh. But I didn't realize how harsh until she told me that she had been arrested for drunken driving in the driveway of her own house. She hadn't even been on a public road. She also told me that the cops had arrested her because they didn't like the way she talked to them. In that jail, it was nothing to see a woman brought in all beat up. In some cases, the only charge was resisting arrest. A Puerto Rican sister was brought in one night. She had been so badly beaten by the police that the matron on duty didn't want to admit her. "I don't want her dying on my shift," she kept saying. It was days before this sister was able to get out of bed. In spite of all of it, those sisters kept the place jumping. They told all kinds of funny stories about their lives, things they had seen and experienced. Some had a natural knack for comedy. What amazed me was the way they told the saddest stories in the world and made everybody laugh about them.
Girl, that nigga always in my pocketbook stealing my money. And all he did with it was blow it at the racetracks. Girl, that man spent so much money on the racetracks, he made me wish I was a horse. One day I fixed his ass, though. I was sick and tired of his mess. Betcha he won't go in nobody's pocketbook no time soon. I put a mousetrap in that sucker. Girl, you should have heard that nigga howl.
My husband and me, we used to fight like cats and dogs. And he was jealous as the day is long. Child, we went to the bar this night, and that nigga got all high and started thinking I was messing around with some dude at the bar. As soon as we got outside, boy, he jumped on me like a gorilla jumps on a banana. Don't you know that man hit me so hard he knocked my teeth straight out of my mouth? Now hold on a minute, I told that fool. We can fight later. I ain't got no another $400 to spend on no false teeth. Child, we was drunk as skunks, down on our knees for about an hour looking for those teeth. And when that fool found him, he said the teeth jumped up and tried to bite him. Poor child, that man is a fool.
I could listen to those stories only when the outside door was open. During the day, they had a female sheriff's officer posted outside my cell. When she was there, the door usually stayed open. The whole time I was at the jail, I saw very few white women. The few who did come were there only a few hours a day or so before they were bailed out. There was one white woman who was busted on the turnpike with 50 pounds of reefer. Everyone waited to see what her bail would be. Then we found out she had been released on her own recognizance. That is, without bond. To be released on recognizance in the state of New Jersey, one of the requirements is Jersey residence. The woman lived in Vermont. But nobody was really shocked. She was white. I was going crazy in that little cell. The only time they let me out was for visits and to see the so-called doctor. I have always been an active and restless person, and being locked up in that little cage all day drove me wild. I needed to stretch my legs. I started to run around the cell. I would run in this tiny circle until I was exhausted. 2 or 3 days after I started, the warden, Miss Bitch, accompanied by some male guards, visited me. "We hear that you're running around your cell," she said. "You will have to stop this activity at once."
"What? Why?"
"Because you are disturbing the people downstairs."
"What people?"
"There is an office underneath you and you are disturbing the workers."
"Are you crazy? They'll just have to be disturbed. I don't run for that long anyhow. If you let me go out into the yard to exercise with the other women, I'll stop running around my cell."
"I order you to stop running around your room."
"I don't remember joining your army," I said.
"When I join your army, then you can order me around."
She left in a huff, and I kept on running.
That was the end of that. I have to thank her, though. If she hadn't come and harassed me, I would have probably given up running around that tiny space in a few days. The food in the workhouse was horrible. Actually, it was disgusting. The food there is worse than the food in any jail that I have been in since, and that is quite an accomplishment. I would sit and wait for lunch or dinner, hungry as hell, and they would bring me some greenish, brown, iridescent chunks floating around in watery liquid, liver stew they called it, or some lamb fat floating around in some water which was supposed to be lamb stew. And that nasty, foul-smelling stuff tasted much worse than it looked. The place was infested with flies, and so was the food. The only thing edible was the eggs, when they had them, and mashed potatoes. I lived off the nuts and candy I bought from the commissary, and the fruit my family brought on visits. Every single day, for one whole week, they brought us this nasty stuff that was supposed to be ravioli. Well, that was the last straw. We all decided to go on a food strike. I wrote a petition, which everybody signed, and we sent it down to the warden's office. Later, the warden agreed to discuss making the food more edible, but he refused to talk to me. He said the fact that I had referred to the food as slop showed I was unreasonable.
The food was better for a few days, and then it reverted to the same old nasty slop. The woman sheriff's officer who guarded me had to be the oldest dumb blonde alive. She played the part to a bust. She was nosy and was the world's biggest gossip. Every time she saw me, she smiled and pretended to be oh so friendly. One day, some workmen were drilling a big hole in the wall to install new electrical circuits. Of course, as soon as she came in, the nosy sheriff's officer began her questions.
What are they building?
I said, haven't you heard? Well, you know they passed a special law, and they're going to execute me. They're building the gas chamber now.
Well, she said indignantly, well, nobody told me about it.
And she rushed off to find out why no one had informed her. The lights were turned off every night at 10. I was lucky because there was a night switch that I controlled in the bathroom adjacent to my cell. I would move the cot so that I was in as much light as possible, and I would read way into the night. When I tired of reading, I'd turn off the light and look out the window. Outside, police patrolled the area. A lot of times there were two police on foot who seemed to be standing around near the parking lot. They carried rifles and shotguns. One night, in my usual condition of boredom, while standing at the window and feeling mischievous, I cried out a bird-like sound in the shrillest voice I could muster.
Eek! 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 Eek!
The pigs started looking around like crazy. They jerked this way and that way as if they thought someone was behind them. Again I cried, this time, they really jumped around. You would have thought it was World War II and the Japanese were 2 feet away. I waited a while. When they calmed down in a voice even shriller than before, I cried,
Nai! Nai! Nai!
They pointed their guns and actually walked backwards, preparing to fire at anything moving. Then quite by accident, my metal cup fell to the floor. Well, in a second, they were down on the ground, crawling, holding their rifles. When I saw these fools crawling around on the ground like that, I just couldn't take it anymore. I laughed until I was sick. Great big bad police crawling around, scared of their own shadows. Every once in a while, I tried it again with different police, and usually the results were similar, but it was never as good as that first night. Because I had a broken clavicle, I had to wear a figure-eight brace around my shoulders. It was made of foam and cotton with a tiny belt buckle fastener in the back, about a half inch wide. One morning as I was eating, the guard came to my cell and took it. You can't have this.
Why?
Because it contains metal, she replied. You can't have anything with metal on it. Now there I was, sitting on a metal cot, drinking out of a metal cup, eating out of a metal bowl, and this policewoman was standing in my face and telling me I couldn't have my brace because of this tiny metal buckle. I raised all the hell I could, but I saw that she was, like she said, like they all say, only following orders. If the prison doctor says you need it, you can have it back. As soon as Dr. Miller came into the workhouse, I asked to see him. Without the brace, my shoulder felt weak and fragile. I could barely hold myself up straight. Don't worry about that old brace, Herr Doctor told me. You don't need that thing anyway. It was all I could do not to kick him in his groin. Luckily, later that week, the bone specialist came from the hospital to see me. He was a very good doctor and a very kind man. He told the warden that in no uncertain terms that I needed my brace, and without it, I could be disfigured. He gave me a lot of encouragement for my hand so that I could regain full use of it. Finally, they returned the brace. It was about that time that the miracle started. I was sure now that my hand was coming back to life. I was beginning to be able to tell it to do things and it would actually respond. Each little bit of progress was a miracle. Being able to touch my pinky with my thumb, to pick up a cup, to hold a pencil, to pinch myself, were feats that took days of practice and exercise to accomplish. And then the day came when I knew I was almost there. After months of trying, I could finally snap my fingers. Whenever anyone came to see me, I would show them my new talents. I felt like a little kid saying, "Look, Mommy, see what I can do." Finally, a joint conference was arranged between Sundiata and me with Evelyn present. It took place at the workhouse. Sundiata was brought from the New Brunswick jail. I've never been happier to see anyone in my life. It was difficult to talk because the guards were practically sitting in our laps. I can't whisper for nothing, and Evelyn kept telling me to lower my voice. We talked about the case and decided that it was politically correct to be tried together. Just seeing Sundiata cooled me right out. I was feeling bad, and I was real self-conscious about how I looked. I had broken out in a horrible rash from the prison soap, and I looked like a lopsided scarecrow with bumps. There is something about Sundiata that exudes calm. From every part of his being, you can sense the presence of revolutionary spirit and fervor. And his love for black people is so intense that you can almost touch it and hold it in your hand. There's nothing put on about him. He is a real folksy kind of person. Every time I see him, he looks like he belongs on a porch somewhere down south, breathing in the summer air and bouncing babies off his knee. The truth of the matter is that Sundiata is country. He would deny it to the bitter end, but he is sure enough country. And when he laughs, that giggle laugh of his, it's like a trip to Texas in the backwoods. When the conference ended, I was a different person. I felt much stronger, and I didn't feel alone. I don't know when, but somewhere along the way, I started to collect the metal cups we were given to drink from. At first, I think it was just my slow way of drinking that caused the cups to accumulate. I was none too popular with the guards, especially the men. Most of them hadn't said boo to me and vice versa, but they hated my guts. To them, I was a cop killer, and they were cops. Something told me to be real careful. They had given me a little table to eat and write on, and at night, before I went to sleep, I pushed the table up next to the bars and stacked the cups precariously on top of it. The bars opened into the cell, and the slightest movement would send the whole stack of cups clanging to the floor. I would push the wooden bench behind the table. In that way, anyone who tried to come in would have to apply some real pressure. I went through this routine every night, feeling slightly foolish, but compelled. One night, in the middle of the night, the cups came crashing down. I immediately awoke to find 4 or 5 male guards standing in the doorway of my cell. I screamed, "What do you want? What are you doing in my cell?" loud enough for someone to hear me. The guards stood in the doorway like they didn't know what to do. Finally, one of them locked the door and said, "We heard a noise and we came to investigate. We were just checking it out." They weren't even supposed to be in the women's section. The female guard on duty that night, the slimiest one in the prison, was nowhere in sight. After that, no matter what jail I was in, I always found some way to barricade my cell. In prisons, it is not at all uncommon to find a prisoner hanged or burned to death in his cell. No matter how suspicious the circumstances, these deaths are always ruled suicides. They are usually black inmates, considered to be a threat to the orderly running of the prison. They are usually among the most politically aware and socially conscious inmates in the prison. When Eva came to the workhouse, it was something of an event. Usually she occupied the cell I was in. The rest of the women were housed in 2 open dormitories. The guards didn't know what to do with her. She had been in that jail many times before, and she was known as a hellraiser. Everybody said she was crazy. My first encounter with Eva was when she came over to the bars and sat down outside my cell and told me she could astro travel. She called it something like astro space projection. "I can go anywhere I want to, whenever I want to," she told me. "I've just come from Jupiter." "How was it?" I asked her. "Oh, it was fine. They had these cute little people. They were purple with crocodile skin and blue hair." "You can go anywhere you want," she told me. "You just have to project yourself. Can you show me how to project myself the hell out of here?
Oh, that's easy, she said. I do it all the time. As a matter of fact, I'm not here now.
No, I said. That's not good enough. I want to project my mind and my body out of here.
You'll be in jail wherever you go, Eva said.
You have a point there, I told her. But I'd rather be in a minimum security prison or on the streets than in a maximum security prison in here. The only difference between here and the streets is that one is maximum security and the other is minimum security. The police patrol our communities just like the guards patrol here. I don't have the faintest idea of how it feels to be free. Eva told me that she knew how I felt. She had to know. Any black person in America, if they are honest with themselves, have got to come to the conclusion that they don't know what it feels like to be free. We aren't free politically, economically, or socially. We have very little power over what happens in our lives. In fact, a black person in America isn't even free to walk down the street. Walk down the wrong street in the wrong neighborhood at night, and you know what happens. Eva and I got on famously. A lot of times I didn't understand what in the world she was talking about. But at times, she made so much sense I wondered if it was really the world that was crazy. She taught me a lot about prison, and she was forever telling some funny story about her life. Eva was a huge sister. She weighed about 300 pounds. She had very dark skin and her hair was cut short next to her scalp. People who have accepted white European standards of beauty would find her unattractive. But to me, there was something beautiful about her, and I'd love to look at her. She is one of the few people that I have met in life who have the courage to be almost totally honest. Altogether, Eva had spent about 10 years in the Clinton Correctional Facility for Women in New Jersey. She had been there in the old days when the women worked out on the farm. She told me how the women were treated, that state troopers would be called in for the slightest disturbance. She was there during a riot at Clinton, and she had seen state troopers beat the women mercilessly. Once they had beaten a pregnant woman so badly, she lost her baby. Around this time, I started taking my little walks. Staying cooped up in that cage all day was driving me up the wall. So when the guards brought my food, I would walk past them into what was called the day room, where the women ate and watched TV. I would walk first to one dorm, then to the other, and then return to my cell. There was no place I could run to, since there were two or three locked doors between me and the outside. Most of the guards would nag me to come back into my cell, and after a short time, I would. But none of them got too crazy about it until one day, a guard yelled at me. Get back here! Did you hear me? Get back here! If there's one thing I can't stand, it's being ordered around. And if there's another thing that makes me go wild, it's for a white person to talk to me in that tone of voice. You make me come here, I told her. You so big and bad, I want to see you make me come back in there. She made a move like she was going to grab me. You put your hands on me and it's going to be you and me. You lay a hand on me, and I'm going to splatter your brains all over these walls. It's a good thing she didn't try me, though, because she outweighed me by at least 50 pounds, and I was still pretty much the one-armed bandit. But I would have given her a hell of a fight. I was mad and frustrated, and I already stored up about 2 or 3 months of anger. Anyway, I finally went back to the cell when I was ready. But her attitude made me defiant. Whenever she opened my cell for anything, I would push past her and walk around for a minute. She would stand in the doorway, like she was a door or something, and I would rear back and butt her out of the way. She was as big as a house, but she didn't have one bit of strength. Finally, she called the male guards. I was in one of the dorms talking to the women, wondering why she wasn't bothering me, when about 10 male guards came into the room. Who is Joanne Chesimard? The head guard asked. Nobody said anything. Which one of you is Joanne Chesimard? They looked like they were ready to leap on somebody. Again, no one responded. All right, I'm going to ask you again. Which one of you is Joanne Chesimard.
I'm Joanne Chesimard, Eva said.
Well, when the guards took one look at Eva and saw how big she was, their tone changed immediately.
Miss Chesimard, would you please return to your cell?
One of the guards came from the back and tapped the sergeant on the shoulder.
I know her, he said. She's not Chesimard.
I am who you are looking for, I said. I didn't want Eva to get too involved in my madness. I'll see you sisters later. I've had enough excitement for the moment. I walked past them, and I went to my cell and opened a book. The next day, this same guard managed to tick me off again.
I don't want any more trouble out of you, she said. I don't want to have to call the men again. You can call the National Guard, the militia, the FBI, and anybody else for all I care.
You can call your mother if you want to, I told her. As soon as she opened the door for lunch, I pushed right past her. I took my tray, sat down with the other women, and started eating my lunch. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I wanted to see what they were going to do. I had about 3 mouthfuls of food left on my plate when the goon squad came in.
All right, get up and get in your cell.
As soon as I finished what I have on my plate.
Now, they ordered.
I only have 2 spoonfuls left.
Now,
they beckoned the female guard.
Remove the prisoner to her cell.
She came near me with her hands stretched out.
Don't you put your hands on me, I told her.
I'll walk to my cell.
Remove the prisoner to her cell, they ordered.
She went to grab my arm, and all at once the room was in motion. Chairs, tables, cups, trays were flying in the air. Everybody was either running to get out of the way or fighting. The female guard made a wild dash for the door. The male guards jumped on me. I was hitting, kicking, scratching, punching, biting, and I don't know what all else. They finally managed to get me in my cell, and the other women locked in their dormitories. None of the women were seriously injured. I had a few nicks and scratches, but otherwise I was fine. And I felt fine. Some of that anger pent up inside me had been released. One of the guards was wounded. Somehow his face had got cut.